This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 15, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear what organized labor is looking for in a presidential platform. A travel and commercial crossing ban, along with an international boycott against Hamas, is creating a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. And D.C. Metro's city government threatens the Answer Coalition with more than $10,000 worth of fines for promoting an upcoming march. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The death toll from a series of suicide bomb attacks near the city of Mosul in Iraqi Kurdistan has passed 250. Emergency workers and local residents are still searching through the wreckage left by yesterday's blasts. The near-simultaneous truck bombs targeted the Yazidis, an ethnically Kurdish community which practices an ancient religion that predates Islam. The American military has blamed the attack on Muslim extremists opposed to the practice of the Yazidi religion. In addition to the more than 250 confirmed deaths, at least 350 people were injured, making it the single deadliest attack since the start of the occupation. Canada has a new defense minister as a result of changes made in the Prime Minister's cabinet. Stefan Christoph reports from Montreal.
Canada's Minister of National Defense, Gordon O'Connor, was the first to go in a reshuffle of the country's conservative cabinet. O'Connor has been implicated in a number of scandals regarding the behavior of Canadian armed forces in Afghanistan. In April, the Globe and Mail newspaper released a detailed report documenting the torture of former Afghan detainees while in government custody in Kandahar. The report held Canadian military forces responsible for the transfer of detainees to the Afghan cells where the torture took place. Opposition political parties and anti-war activists have been calling for the resignation of Canada's Minister of Defence ever since. Former Minister of Foreign Affairs Peter MacKay has replaced Gordon O'Connor as Defence Minister. O'Connor has been demoted to the portfolio of National Revenue. The move is widely regarded as a result of mounting pressure on the Conservative government over the controversial Afghan military mission. But anti-war activists in Canada argue that the shift in the cabinet offers no fundamental change to the political direction of the government. This is Stefan Christoph reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Montreal.
The Bush administration has decided to designate parts of Iran's Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization. The Revolutionary Guard is a military organization close to the president and independent of Iran's armed forces. It is the first time that an official entity of a foreign government has been included in the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. Any firms under U.S. jurisdiction found to be doing business with or supplying goods to Iran's Revolutionary Guard would be subject to legal action. The news comes as Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns is in Jerusalem to discuss a $30 billion military aid package to Israel. Jurors in Miami are deliberating in the terrorism support trial of Jose Padilla and his two co-defendants. Mitch Perry reports from WMNF in Tampa.
The arrest of Jose Padilla in June of 2002 was heralded by the FBI and the Bush administration as a significant strike in the war on terror. Then Attorney General John Ashcroft announced Padilla's detention while in Russia. The Justice Department labeled Padilla an enemy combatant and accused him of working with someone in Pakistan on plans to build and explode a radioactive dirty bomb in the U.S. However, after being held in a Navy brig for more than 3 years, Padilla and his two co-defendants were charged with providing material aid to terrorists and of conspiracy to murder, maim, and kidnap people overseas. There was nothing about a dirty bomb in his indictment. During closing arguments on Tuesday, Padilla's attorney, public defender Michael Caruso, told the jury that Padilla did not fill out an al-Qaeda application, did not train with al-Qaeda, and did not plot to kill anybody in the name of Islam. That al-Qaeda application in question was found in Afghanistan in 2001. A government expert witness said that Padilla's fingerprints were all over the front and back of the five-page form. If found guilty, Padilla and his co-defendants could face life in prison. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
A Christian church's proposal to build a multi-million dollar development in a town northeast of Boulder, Colorado, was at the center of a heated city council debate last night. Maeve Conran reports.
Longmont City Council chambers were packed to capacity Tuesday evening as the council took public comment before deciding on a development proposal by a local Christian megachurch. Lifebridge Church wants to develop a nearly 400-acre piece of land that they already own to build a church, a multi-million-dollar sports arena, as well as residential and commercial buildings. Lifebridge wants the development to be annexed into Longmont city limits in order to receive city services such as road maintenance, garbage pickup and water. But many Longmont residents are upset by the multi-million-dollar development proposal. The church is a non-profit entity and therefore exempt from paying taxes. Jen Gartner handed a petition with more than 850 signatures to the City Council last night, asking that the annexation be put to a public vote.
My biggest concern is that this seems to be a colossal tax giveaway from the people of Longmont to a corporation. And I think that the people just need to really understand the complexity of this.
Several members of the Lifebridge Church spoke in favour of the annexation at Tuesday's City Council meeting, saying the church, which has 3,000 members in Longmont, needs room to expand. Only one City Council member echoed the concerns about the environmental impact of the development, as well as the tax implications brought forth by the residents opposed to the development. The Longmont City Council approved the measure 6-1. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Maeve Conran in Colorado.
The last of 12 protesters sentenced to prison time for demonstrations against the U.S. military presence in Vieques has been released. Jose Perez Gonzalez returned to Puerto Rico yesterday after serving 4 years in a Mississippi prison. Gonzalez was sentenced for damaging a guard shack on the military bombing grounds as hundreds celebrated the military's departure. Supporters greeted him at the airport before he had to report to a halfway house where he will live for the duration of his sentence. For decades, the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps used a huge section of the Puerto Rican island for bombing target practice. Many Vieques residents blamed the bombs for the highest cancer rate in Puerto Rico. Civil disobedience calling for an end to the bombing began in 1999 when target practice bombs killed a local resident. The military ceased its bombing operations on the island on May 1st of 2003. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's government is in crisis. Steadily escalating violence is matched by a near-complete collapse of government services and functions. Al-Maliki's cabinet initially included members of diverse Iraqi communities, but met obstacles with the withdrawal of the Sunni Accordance Front and several parties boycotting cabinet meetings. As FSRN's Hiba Dawood reports, the pretense of national unity and cooperation is now gone.
The Iraqi government appears increasingly dysfunctional. The Iraqi members of parliament have gone on holiday, many of them leaving the country, leaving the people who elected them behind to survive as best they can. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's cabinet is shrinking fast. 17 out of 34 ministers have so far resigned from his government, triggering crisis talks in Baghdad this week.
We are marginalized and the government is going in a unique direction for marginalization of other people.
Al-Maliki is a member of the Iraqi Accordance Front, the latest party to leave cabinet. He says his party has withdrawn to underline long-standing demands for the release of detainees and to fix what the party sees as imbalances in the ministries of interior and defense.
It is not easy that we just say we return back on certain conditions. We offered about 11 concerns and explained how these to be fulfilled. We are ready, yes, for negotiations. It's not important that we return back to the government or stay outside, but we want really to improve and mobilize the political set, which is, in our view, completely paralyzed.
Maliki has proved incapable of managing the demands of the parties represented in his government. The Fadila party withdrew in a protest against selective replacement of key officials in the oil ministry, for example, with others more friendly to al-Maliki. Before them, the Sadr movement bloc of 6 ministers quit when Prime Minister refused to set a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. The Sadrists, however, still view the current administration as representative of the Iraqi people. Hamdallah Rakabi is a member of the Sadr movement.
Although some parties have resigned, including the Sadr bloc, it doesn't mean that this government is not legitimate. This government has made mistakes, and we have problems with it. But the failures that have happened and continue to happen and will happen are because of the presence of the occupation forces. This is the main and essential reason. The occupation forces are trying to make this government fail by interfering in the security situation and other issues.
But the decomposition of the government reflects the reality of a bitter sectarian violence, which this week extended its reach to the minority Yazidi community. A series of bombings yesterday killed more than 200 people and wounded hundreds more in two villages in north of Iraq. The Iraqi Coalition Casualty Count website, which compiles media reports of the Iraqi dead, said more than 824 Iraqis have been violently killed since the beginning of August. Baghdad resident Riyad Hamid says people don't care about the government anymore.
These resignations didn't change the situation. We want something to change the situation with electricity and fuel. This is all a political game among the politicians. It's all about political benefits. These resignations are not serious. It's a show of force. But our situation is very bad. No jobs, no electricity, no fuel, no water, just a lot of explosions.
Talks between Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and his former ministers and other political leaders continue in Baghdad this week. For FSRN, this is Hiba Dawood.
A strict international boycott against Hamas's rule over Gaza, doubled with a complete Israeli travel and commercial crossing ban imposed since June, are leading to a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
A recent public opinion poll conducted in the Gaza Strip by the Ramallah-based Near East Consulting, an independent international research group, showed that the closure of Gaza since Hamas took over the coastal region in June has drastically impacted the economy. The poll, which included 400 Gaza residents, revealed that 80% of the population has been affected financially. The Israeli government says it closed travel and commercial crossings into the Gaza Strip due to concerns over Israel's security since the militant Islamic group Hamas took control of Gaza. According to the United Nations Works and Relief Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, the poverty rate in Gaza is at its highest ever, and agency spokesperson Adnan Abu Hasna says the number of people requiring aid is at unprecedented proportions.
We think that the humanitarian situation is deteriorating, and we expect that after a few weeks that Gaza will be depending 100% on the humanitarian aid, and that is something that did not happen before. If the crossing points to Gaza Strip are not open in the coming few weeks, we think that the humanitarian situation will deteriorate. The unemployment rate will raise. The poverty rate also is rising in a very serious rate.
Local residents in Gaza are greatly disappointed over the Hamas-Fatah power struggle that has led to current conditions. Mohammed Iqdeh is a farmer from southern Gaza.
If I belonged to Hamas, Hamas would welcome me and dance for me. But if I were not a supporter, imagine what would happen to me. Why all this? We are all Muslims. Why are we struggling? What is going on is against the interest of the people. Affiliation with either Hamas or Fatah cannot be the criterion. Islam does not say this. We are all brothers. All that we do should be for the sake of our homeland. And if not, then our homeland is heading back 50 years and it won't be liberated.
Hamas closed a chapter of an intermittent factional infighting with its rival Fatah party in June by taking over Gaza, thus undermining totally the first ever Palestinian unity government. Israel, which never recognized the Hamas government after the latter took power in January 2006, imposed a strict closure on the Gaza Strip, denying access of goods and commodities to its 1.4 million residents. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
The Democratic Party candidates for president have begun to earnestly court the labor vote. The major candidates have taken part in a series of labor-sponsored town hall meetings in recent weeks, with a large candidates forum in Chicago last week. Labor expects to play a decisive role in the upcoming elections and is counting on getting its issues on the agenda. FSRN's Max Pringle reports.
The 13-million-member AFL-CIO, the nation's largest labor federation, will reportedly free its member unions to endorse whomever they please and forego a federation-wide endorsement for president in 2008. Steve Smith is AFL-CIO spokesperson. He says workers are losing ground on wages, but first and foremost, on the minds of working people, is what the next president plans to do to tackle the nation's health care crisis.
Workers in this country are in dire need of a health care system that works for them, which it clearly doesn't at this point. And so we're going to be looking to hear more from the candidates about what their plans for universal health care in this country are in the coming months as we get closer to 2008.
For its part, the offshoot Change to Win coalition is holding off making an endorsement until the candidates for the Democratic nomination for president release more detailed proposals on issues important to labor. Greg Denier is director of public affairs for Change to Win. He says labor will be watching how each candidate addresses other important issues like international trade agreements. Denier says current trade agreements don't raise living standards, but instead send good-paying manufacturing jobs overseas.
They favor corporate interest over a developmental interest where we would raise wages, where we would raise living standards. We'd raise the level that workers live in countries around the world. Instead of raising standards, what they're doing is using trade, using the export of jobs to lower standards in the United States.
So far, only Ohio Representative Dennis Kucinich has advocated repealing trade agreements like NAFTA and the WTO. Kucinich says he'd pull the U.S. out of NAFTA and the WTO on his first day in office. Labor has been highly critical of what they call the Bush administration's anti-worker legislation. Greg Denier of Change to Win says the administration's 2005 bankruptcy bill was a gift to corporate interests.
They've allowed corporations to use bankruptcy laws to avoid paying their pensions, to cancel retiree health benefits, and avoid union contracts. At the same time, they passed a bankruptcy law that said working families, no matter how far in debt they go, can't declare bankruptcy to get out of debt that they owe to corporate America. So what we have is an imbalance of power in the United States.
Steve Smith of the AFL-CIO says one way to give labor a stronger voice in the national debate is for the next president to sign the so-called Employee Free Choice Act into law. President Bush has threatened to veto it. The Free Choice Act would allow workers to unionize a workplace if a majority of them sign cards to that effect. Current law requires a lengthy election process, which unions say allow employers too much time to interfere.
The freedom to form and join unions and bargain collectively with employers is a huge issue that these candidates, we're going to be looking to hear more from them about in the coming months. Certainly the Employee Free Choice Act was a priority for many people in labor unions around this country.
Every Democratic candidate has shown support for the act. The AFL-CIO Smith says he's waiting to see each candidate's plan to help push it through the Senate, where it stalled this summer. Meanwhile, Smith says, labor is also watching to see each candidate's stance on declining pension benefits.
We're in danger of this current generation of retirees perhaps being the last generation of retirees ever in this country, because people more and more are having to work later and later in life, and they don't have a secure retirement. They don't have pension. They find themselves in increasingly dire financial straits as they get older.
The 1.8 million member Service Employees International Union, the nation's largest union, will meet next month to consider endorsements for the 2008 elections. The union, which is a member of Change to Win, has reportedly been leaning toward former North Carolina Senator John Edwards, who ran on John Kerry's ticket in 2004 on a pro-labor platform. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in San Francisco.
The D.C. Metro City government is threatening the Answer Coalition with more than $10,000 worth of fines unless the organization brings down posters promoting a massive anti-war march on Capitol Hill on September 15. The city government has given Answer just 72 hours to bring the posters down. Answer has responded by reminding the city that the posters conform to the city's regulations and are protected through the First Amendment, and adds that the approach is simply a way to silence the nation's growing anti-war movement and the September 15 mobilization in particular. We spoke with Ian Thompson. He's an organizer with Answer Coalition LA, who explained DC Metro's threat.
They say what we can do is to take down all the posters ourselves. And literally, there are thousands of posters up. Many volunteers, many dozens of volunteers have been going throughout the city for weeks doing this. It's the first time this has happened, and it's just unreasonable that we would take any of them down because, frankly, it's our legal right to put them up.
So to be clear, are the posters on any kind of private property?
No, they're not on private property at all. They're on public property, on lampposts and things like that, where the regulations stipulate they can be. I mean, we fought hard for the ability to put up advertisements for our posters. We don't have tens of millions of dollars like Fox News and other places, or any political candidates who put things up all over D.C. area. So we believe it's selective enforcement against this particular anti-war mobilization on September 15th.
Let's talk about Fox News, because it seems like they had a pretty heavy hand in pushing DC's city government to come to this decision. Can you talk about Fox News's role in all of this?
They certainly did have a big role in it. They brought their cameras out to where some of the posters had been put up and showed how difficult, in their estimation, it was to get these posters off of the property. And there are various groups in gentrified areas, which used to be African-American majority areas in D.C., that are leading the charge as well. Or the government's helping to whip these people up, saying, in the name of beautification, we need to have these posters down. When, in fact, they don't say that when John Edwards or Hillary Clinton puts up posters. So Fox News certainly put a spotlight on this and helped whip up the frenzy that had been initiated by the D.C. city government, which also, of course, has been contacted and is close communication with the Department of the Interior, which is a federal department. So I think the federal government and its local counterparts view this mobilization as politically threatening to their interests, which is, you know, continuing the war in Iraq.
And again, have you heard of any other organization or political candidate, as you mentioned, have any type of threat like this at all?
No, not at all. I think that the D.C. Public Works Department claims that they make everybody adhere to these regulations and that it's not selective enforcement based on content, but it's just not the case. We've never heard it. You can go through D.C. now during the campaign season and see posters up for everybody. So it really is targeting the anti-war movement and what will be a large demonstration in D.C. on September 15th.
How serious do you think that these threats are from the city government to fine Answer more than $10,000 for having these posters up?
Well, I think it's a serious threat because we don't have a lot of money to continue the mobilization. We are raising funds, and we do believe that we're not going to pay a penny of this. We know it's unconstitutional, and it needs to be pushed back. And what we're asking people to do, many thousands have already done this, is to send letters. We have set up a nice e-mechanism so people can fax in their repudiation of these fines to the Department of Public Works. And you can get to this information at answercoalition.org. It's also been very effective for people to call the D.C. mayor and the Department of Public Works demanding that the fines and the harassment and the repression of the anti-war movement be stopped. We believe we have a right to publicize this September 15th march. So we're keeping this campaign going. We know the fines will keep rolling in, but a mobilization can push this back, we believe.
Ian Thompson is an organizer with Answer Coalition LA.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Black August has many markers throughout the long history of resistance in the Americas. There are more than we could ever recount here, but here are a few that are important and undeniable events that affected other events and indeed had global impact. It was a hot, humid morning in August 1619 when dark-skinned Africans were unloaded from a ship in the English colony of Jamestown in Virginia. They were called indentured servants by the people who purchased their contracts. It is unknown what the Dutch sailors called them. Some 30 years later, they would be called something that millions of other Africans would be called on American shores for the next 200 years, slaves. They were, in fact, captives, chained, stolen captives of a vicious race war against black life by the merchant princes of Europe. For those people who call themselves African Americans, their unique history begins here. On August 21st, 1831, the explosive rebellion of Nat Turner turned Southern society inside out. Although he has been labeled by traditional, that is, white historians, as a madman, Turner was in fact a deeply religious man who was moved by signs and portents that he saw in the summer sky, compelling him to fight for the freedom of his captive people. Only in a slavocracy would the idea of freedom fighting and resistance seem mad. Some 30 years after Nat Turner's rebellion, the Civil War would deal a death blow to American bondage. August 30th, 1856. When the name of John Brown is evoked, the shadow of Harper's Ferry arises in the mind of the small group of rebels who tried unsuccessfully to seize an American armory and foment rebellion among the slaves. But years before Harper's Ferry, John Brown had waged war against pro-slavery forces in Osawatomie, Kansas, after Missourians had sacked the town of Lawrence, Kansas, some 3 months earlier. The fighting in Kansas led to excited reports about bleeding Kansas. What they were tough, nasty border wars between anti- and pro-slavery forces, each trying to dominate the other. Indeed, Brown was called Osawatomie Brown before Harper's Ferry marked him as a martyr for the sacred cause of freedom. August 11th to 16th, 1965. The fires of Watts, a black community in Los Angeles, California, were marked as for rebellion for the generation of blacks in the 1960s. These rebellions, staged in response to brutal police attacks on people, cost the lives of 34 people and also almost $20 million worth of property damaged or destroyed. August 8, 1978, one of the earlier MOVE confrontations. Some 9 MOVE men and women were sent to prison for hundreds of years, stemming from a deeply flawed trial. MOVE members continue to fight for the release of their imprisoned comrades. MOVE veterans of the August 8th police assault have been imprisoned for 25 years in dungeons throughout Pennsylvania. They remain rebellious spirits who oppose a repressive status quo. The spirit of Black August moves through centuries of black, Indian, and multicultural resistance. It is an emblem of the spirit of freedom. It is a long smoldering spark of the fire in the hearts of a people, hearts burning and yearning for freedom. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Tina Gysi and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young, and our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Antonio Ortiz and Puck Lowe, sitting in for Eric Klein. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Ara Bogado.